Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is a, this is a little bit of a change of style subject. There is no death, really. There's no murder, really. There's a death that I'm going to talk about, and there's probably a crime or two. But anyway, it is Old Hollywood, and once again, joined in the Old Hollywood quest with me is Jen. Jen, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. And I don't have any bodies to bring, so everyone else should be good, too.
I actually have a kind of body story that goes with our subject, Elia Kazan. Mm. However, he is not directly responsible for the death. He is not one of my favorite people in the whole world.
Well, no, I don't think he's a lot of favorited persons by many in Hollywood and probably many, I guess, in the world from what I read.
He is, however, one of the greatest directors of the mid-20th century and a style that in some cases still holds up today. But I would also argue that his subjects, his actors that he would find contributed greatly to that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Elia Kazan, and then I will weave in stuff.
I love when you weave in stuff and bring in blinds. Okay, so Elia Kazan is one of the most polarizing and controversial cinematic figures. Huge influential director. I mean, brilliant guy. He started off on Broadway. He was a New York native. Then he made his way to Hollywood. Okay, so he finds himself in Tinseltown, and then he says to himself, why am I here? Well, that's because movies are made there. You know, Hollywood was booming. If you wanted to make movies, that's where you needed to be. So he would write back home to his wife, and he would say, I hate it here in every shrieking, insane way. It's like a grave, a tomb, except it's all very fancy, full of very fine people, all in various stages of decomposition, without knowing. So he'd become notorious for his work, but also for these sharp letters that he penned. And there was a lot of them. He also became notorious for censorship wars, red hot politics, and I do mean red, and that famous Hollywood blacklist. And this is all in between his extramarital affairs with Marilyn Monroe, and then the talent that he goes on to discover, some of the biggest names that we still love today.
Yeah, I mean, and he co-founded the Actors Studio in 1947, and that is where the whole method acting started. And, you know, and so many he found, you know, he's the one who discovered James Dean. He's the one who discovered Marlon Brando. It just some of the biggest names. And he had this preference for unknown actors. That was just kind of his thing. He liked being able to find these people and then mold them into something he liked. And I think that there's something to that. That way he could say, this is how I want it. So I think he discovered Eva Marie Saint, and who won an Oscar for her very first movie, which was On the Waterfront. You know, so, I mean, the guy obviously had an eye for people. He is the one who founded Warren Beatty. So, you know, he put him in the first movie, which was Splendor in the Grass with Natalie Wood. So, I mean, the guy had an eye for finding new people. But at the same time, like you said, you know, he had a lot of personal issues or personal failings, I would say. And I kind of want to go, I guess, you know, that letter that you read, there is a whole book of letters that he wrote.
Yeah, I mean, he really spills the tea. Not only did he discover people that he would come to be very fond of, but before he was actually fond of you, he would talk mad trash. So he would just pen these letters to his wife, who was back in New York, and she was a playwright herself. And he would just talk just all this trash. He would talk about how bad they all acted. And then in the end, he ended up liking them. He would talk about how great they were. I mean, the one about James Dean, Jimmy Dean, as he calls him.
Yeah.
That letter is awesome.
And, you know, there is a letter that he wrote to his wife about his affair with Marilyn Monroe. And it is...
That letter is kind of sad. You know, because he's like, yes, I had an affair with her. I do not regret it. I'm not sorry. And if you want to divorce me, you can. But you know what? I feel like I'm marriage material. And I will just marry again if you leave me.
The reason I can't write you about what I'm ashamed of is because I'm ashamed of it. I don't get that. I'm ashamed I hurt you ever. On the other hand, I resent being made to feel guilty and low and less. This harks back to the worst times I ever had when I felt low and less and all that. I don't feel that way anymore ostensibly. I don't. This guy is just making words. I just want you to know that it's not a philosophy of mine or a callous piece of habitual aggression. And it's not like the earlier episode. Okay, so obviously there was an earlier one that he had written his wife about saying, oh, it's not like the earlier one because I don't feel vengeful, hardly at all, if at all. I guess it's accurate to say not at all. I mean, it's just...
He goes on to say, you know, it might happen again. I can't say that it won't, but I did get a lot out of what I did with Marilyn. You know, it was more beneficial for me, and hopefully it was for her. He's like, at least I was nice to her.
Yeah, and he called Marilyn Monroe. He said, you know, I found her when I was introduced in tears. I took her to dinner because she seemed like a touching, pathetic waif. She sobbed all through dinner. I wasn't interested in her. That came later. I got to know her in time, introduced her to Arthur Miller, who was also taken by her. You know, but... It's fascinating. It says, I'm not ashamed at all. Not a damn bit of, you know, of being attracted to her.
He literally says that. He's like, I am not a damn bit ashamed. And by the way, I loved all the gossip that she gave me on being married to Joe DiMaggio. And the more that I heard about how he hit her and abused her, the more enthralled I was with her stories. And he goes, I actually enjoyed listening to them. And then he tells his wife, well, maybe that's bad terminology. You know, maybe that's the wrong choice of words. But I mean, I did enjoy it.
Yeah. He goes, she's not as big as a sex pot as advertised. You know, I don't know if there are such as advertised big sex pots. You know, I was touched and fascinated, you know, and he goes, I'm not sorry about it. I love you and only want to help you. I'm awful sorry I hurt you. I'm human, though. It might happen again. I hope not. And I have resisted quite some other opportunities. No loss. I just.
Okay, so he has no loss for words in. Much like someone else, he will pen, I kid you not, 1,000 words in a letter. And he wrote letters to just everyone. I mean, whatever he was feeling, he just spilled. It didn't matter if it was politically correct or you just got whatever he was feeling at that moment.
I will say this, that this letter that he wrote to Molly Day, who was his first wife, who died, and then his second wife died, a lot of deaths around him. There is a story. I actually have... Well, there's a lot of people that he touched.
Like physically or you mean, you know.
Yeah, well, there's – I'm trying to find this one. There is – it was the blind that I wrote back in April 2014 and revealed it later in July of 2014. And it's really short. It just says she's one of the most recognizable faces of classic Hollywood. But back when she was on the verge of A-plus list stardom, she slept with many a producer to get a role. One of these casual encounters resulted in a surprise pregnancy, which she ended up terminating. That might explain why she couldn't have kids. And the answer is Marilyn Monroe, but it was always presumed that that particular producer was Elie Kazan. So
that's a good blind.
It is a good blind and very short. You know, that's not my favorite Marilyn Monroe blind because I think it's a little, you know, tragic and sad, but my favorite one is one back in, that I've already read before on the podcast. And it's when she went to go live in a town and, when she was trying to live a normal kind of life and just being in this working class community and then paid for, a funeral for somebody and stuff. So, and that one actually came from a reader who lived in that town and it was part of the public record. It's just that nobody really talked about it very much. So it's that one. If you just go to Blind Items Revealed, Old Hollywood Marilyn Monroe, and it's one where I call her Miss D. It's a really good one. But the reason that I bring up the Marilyn Monroe and I bring up that story is not the one where she's living in the town, but the abortion one, is he wrote this letter to his wife and he made it seem as if he had kind of met her after she had become famous and after all this. And the thing is, he actually met her sooner and he was responsible for what I you know, the whole, did you ever see that movie, you know, Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow?
No.
Okay. So, it's, you know, she, if you, what happens if you make the subway train, you know, in your life, and what happens if you miss it? And it's just kind of like, you know, this, just this alteration in life just by a couple of minutes. So there is this actress who named Barbara Payton, who I consider to be one of the Hollywood's greatest tragedies. And she was 39 when she died, and she'd already been married 5 times. That gives you kind of an idea. And she was up for a role in 1950. She screen tested for The Asphalt Jungle, which was directed by John Huston, and she was going to get the part. And it was this, the mistress of a mob-connected lawyer. And then Elia Kazan stepped in and got John Huston to give the part to Marilyn Monroe. So then what you had is you had Barbara crushed because everybody thought that she had got the role. And then through these, I don't know, with Elia having this relationship with Marilyn Monroe, he said, hey, hey, get her this job. So then she goes over, to see James Cagney, and James Cagney hires her, with his producer brother William. And there's this film, this her, it's not her only film, but it's probably her best film. It was called Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. And it was made in 1950, and she did that instead of Asphalt Jungle. However, the Cagney brothers wanted more from her than just acting. And in a time where the year before she had been making $100 a week with Universal Studios, now with Warner Brothers and Cagney Productions, she's making $5,000 per week in 1950. Somebody who is really not that well known, not known really at all. And what they wanted her for was to have sex with whoever they needed her to have sex with, including themselves, to get actors to come over to their production company, this William Cagney Productions. And Warner Brothers also chipped in because they wanted, you know, bigger names. So in 1950, she ends up, you know, having sex with all these guys and going out all the time and becoming an alcoholic, basically. They throw her in a couple of movies just to make it look like she's making movies. But in this time, she, in 1950, she hooked up with Howard Hughes, Bob Hope, George Raft. It's just this list of men, and they just used her, and abused her to the point where a year after she signed this contract, she was basically, or 2 years after she signed this contract, she's out of Hollywood, and she's forced to prostitute herself on the street. She's an alcoholic. She gets married a couple of more times, and she just kind of struggles through her life until she dies, I think in 1960, I forget, 67. So she was 39 years old. And like I said, married 5 times in that time. And I blame it all on Elia Kazan. Not, you know, entirely, but she was going to get this role, and it was going to be a huge role. It's what made Marilyn Monroe a star, even though it's fairly, it was probably 6th or 7th filled. And to have that kind of taken away from you, and then you think, well, it's going to be a good thing. Now I'm going to make $5,000 a week with Cagney's, and then you realize, oh, this is what they want me for, and I don't know. It just...
That is tragic.
Yeah. It is tragic. And she got married for the first time when she was 16, and then she got married again when she was 17 to some guy who was twice her age, and...
That seems like a pattern with a lot of the female actresses that we talk about.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, she was born in 1927. Now, the thing is, it's crazy, is that she ended up living a couple years longer than Marilyn Monroe. But I mean, it's just a tragic kind of life, and there was nobody to really help her. I don't know. There's some big scandals, but I mean, it's just all these people just used her, and they weren't even, willing to help her later. I mean, when you have Howard Hughes and then Bob Hope, and Bob Hope was married, and, you know, it,
Howard just, Hughes got around. It seems like he
got around. I mean,
he slept and used every person that we wanted to talk about on the podcast. And
I know
when it comes to Kazan, he was shifty when it came to hiring actors and actresses. You know, he would second guess himself a lot and ponder about them. And he would also call up other producers and directors and talk to them about who they were casting and if those people fit the mold of the part. Because what he wrote about Marlon Brando, I mean, he talked about casting Marlon Brando in a film, and he just says, you know, I'm not insane about Brando for this. You know, in my opinion, he's quite wrong, but he's a fine actor. And if he's excited about it and he's willing to work like a beginner, you know, then I'll take him. He's like, but actually, you know, I'm for Paul Newman. So I mean, he's already just kind of second guessing himself. And he goes on to say, well, Paul Newman is just as good looking as Brando. And they tell him that, you know, his masculinity is even stronger. But that was for On the Waterfront, and Brando went on to win an Oscar for that.
Yeah, and then, you know, he worked with Brando again in Streetcar Named Desire. And to me, that kind of shows what Elliot was good at. Because Elliot came from Broadway, like we said. And he won, I think, 4 Tony Awards. And then he won 2 Academy Awards and then an honorary one, which he shouldn't have got, and everybody picketed that he got it, and he was nominated for 5 others. But in Streetcar Named Desire, you know, you kind of, it's, as the thing goes on, he makes it tighter and tighter and tighter if you watch it to make it really, he wanted it big, and then he had to make it smaller and smaller to kind of be what it was on the stage. And
yeah, because he had to fight like hell just to get that film out because of the Hollywood Censorship Board. That's when it was just the most strictest. And that's when he also learned that his pen was mightier than any sword. He fired off so many letters to the guy that was over the censorship board. The guy's name was Joseph Breen, and he literally gave him Hades. He was like, look, I'm going to make this film. I'm going to have my directorial vision and all the artistic rights to like the cinematic storytelling. I want all of that preserved. And I don't care how taboo or risky the film is. This is what the film is about. You know, there's a rape, there's promiscuity, there's loneliness, despair, and you're going to like all of it. Seems like a lot did get cut, though.
Well, here's the thing. They restored some of the original. And that only actually added about 4 or 5 minutes. However, Elia had done an additional 4 or 5 minutes worth that is lost in time because he just did that up front. Now what happened was, it was almost the whole cast, the original cast, except for Jessica Tandy had played Blanche DuBois, and then she was replaced by Vivian Leigh. But so you already had this kind of cast that had been playing it. They already knew what they were going to do. And, you know, there's not that many lines that have been changed. There was one line where Stanley's telling Blanche, you know, maybe you wouldn't be so bad to interfere with. And that had been cut and then restored. And that's in the sequence leading up to the rape. But the thing is the, when you originally cut that out, it makes the scene really, really uglier. So in a way, the fact that he had to cut it, was made it more intense because when it's censored, you got Stanley and he's going towards Blanche and, you know, his animal-like kind of thing. And you got the shots over his shoulder of her backing away and everything. And it's not an easy scene to watch, you know?
No, not at all. And he went on to write about that. He said, you know, you look, if you want me to start cutting stuff out, you know, when we piece it back together, it's just going to be more intense. He said, if you want heavy, this piece is going to be heavy.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing that the censors had the problem with is, you know, you had Stella, you know, who's Stanley's wife, and then, you know, the whole Stella was Hollywood didn't like women who had like a sexual need. You know, they found female sexual desire very, oh well, we can't have women have this sexual desire. And Tennessee Williams, you know, he created this figure that is still kind of disturbing because it's a woman who the sexual need for her husband is so strong that she will be put up with being beaten by him and lie to herself about the destruction of her sister. But the thing is, it's just, I guess when you look at the restored one, when you see something like Stella, there's a scene where she comes back to Stanley and it's after his Stella. and you see her come down the stairs to him. And it's just kind of like, okay, this scene, you realize that Stanley and Stella are in this marriage together and it's just all about sex. And that particular scene, you can kind of feel, okay, well, this is why the censors wanted that taken out. And it's just, but the part of the problem when you look at the movie now is that the direction is really heavy handed and Martin, you know, Brando's so good in it and Vivian Leigh's great in it. And it's really, really, really good. But it's also very disturbing. And I mean, I get why, you know, the censorship board had, you know, wanted to cut some of it, but some of the cuts actually made it even, more violent or more, not violence, but, more difficult to watch. So yeah, I think because he had heavy, to be smarter.
But yeah. He was a person that was known for that. He had the films that had the provocative, issue-driven subject matter. I mean, his Gentleman's Agreement, he dealt with anti-Semitism. He had Pinky, which was talking about how African-Americans were being prejudiced against. And then the Waterfront, union corruption. I mean, he was not afraid to be out front tackling these issues. So Streetcar Named Desire, the rape scene, he was just talking about what Americans didn't want to talk about, but a lot of them, sadly, they've probably experienced something like that or knew someone that did.
Well, I think also, considering that it was 1950-51, that Elia and Tennessee Williams, I mean, to have their view, it was an adult view of sexuality at a time when, okay, because, I mean, Tennessee Williams was, he enjoyed active gay sex life. And Kazan, you know, had an active heterosexual appetite, and they just were both willing to talk about sex. And I think that Kazan said, hey, sex is sex. It doesn't really matter. Let's just get it out there because, you know,
that's exactly what he wrote. He said, neither Tennessee nor I have any intention of cutting out the young collector scene. He said, there's nothing homosexual about the collector. Just because a boy can be delicate does not mean he's a fairy. And the only thing unhealthy is that you think it's degenerate. So he's just basically given it to this Charles K. Feldman, who is someone that was kind of like a go-between between him and the censorship guy that he was fighting with, Bream.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, is just – this is where I have the problem with Elia. It's not that he wasn't a great director because, I mean – and he won for On the Waterfront. He didn't actually even win for Streetcar Named Desire, even though I think it's – I mean, they're both great movies. His other one that he won was for Gentleman's Agreement. I just
– yeah, that's where his best director came in.
Yeah. My thing about him is that the whole turning in people who were communists. You know, back in 1952 – so here's the thing. He was an ex-communist and he wanted to make more movies. So he came under pressure to testify at the House Un-American Activities Committee and it ruined a lot of careers. But because he was so prominent, we're talking about this in 1952. So he's already done, you know, these huge, huge movies and they really, really wanted him to come talk. And he was told that if he did not name names, he might not be allowed to make more films and he would be put on the blacklist. So he testified and he named names.
And he was originally from Turkey and they backed him into a corner. Basically, I'm not taking up for him because I think he's a rat. But still, they backed him into a corner because they knew he was an immigrant from Turkey. His entire family was from Istanbul, Turkey. And their story of how they came over to America is in his film, America, America. And he talks about the uncle coming over first and kissing the soil of American ground once he passes through custom. And he said, you know, if people say I'm over the top, it's likely due to that movie because my uncle really did kiss the ground and there was like an American flag waving in the background and then the Statue of Liberty. I mean, it was just, it was a lot. But he was like, I don't want to give up my career and I don't want to give up you know, being in America. So he gives up 8 names of some of the people he was the closest to in this communist party that he was in. Of course, yeah. Hollywood hated him for it. And it was, you know, then this other guy jumps in, John Leach. He gives up more names. You end up with 42, some of the most heavy-hitting stars ever.
Yeah, and Kazan just was looking out for himself. And, I mean, after he did this in 52, I mean, he made On the Waterfront. He made East of Eden. That's the movie that debuted James Dean. He made Baby Doll, Face in the Crowd, Splendor in the Grass, and then, like you said, America, America. I mean...
Oh, he was good. He had done what government wanted. So, you know, he was free and clear to go and make the movies that he wanted. The 42, which became, you know, there was a Hollywood 10 group that formed out of the ones that were turned in. You know, they became the opposing party.
Yeah.
But he was fine. I mean, they had to basically fight for their lives and their careers.
And why don't you tell everybody what... The whole rat thing that you said, I found that very interesting because there is a modern kind of thing to that where Harvey Weinstein, when he was arrested and going to jail, he had 3 books in his hand. And nobody can read – nobody's ever been able to figure out what one of those books was. But one of the other two was A Life by – Elie Kazan, and talking about ratting out people, kind of saying, hey, I am going to name names, you know, and it just was a real, you know, dig, you know. I know you had mentioned before, it's like when Kate Spade's husband went outside wearing the rat mask or whatever, you know, it's just.
Yeah, there's certain things that stand out, you know, when they start signaling, you know, you have Harvey who's walking in to turn himself into the NYPD first precinct on the rape and, you know, sexual misconduct charges, and he's got this book, and it's just very visible. So you can tell it's a message of some sort. How you interpret Weinstein, it's 2 different ways you could go. He's either saying, hey, you know, you need to acknowledge the fact that I look at this Kazan guy, and the Kazan guy gave up names. I could possibly give up names if things get too hot. Or he could be saying that, hey, I realize that I'm now a part of the Hollywood blacklist, and I will make a comeback. But the thing is that he's already expelled from the Academy, unlike Kazan. So,
yeah,
you know, that big comeback is it's not going to be like that.
Well, yeah, I think that he's not going to have quite the comeback. Go ahead.
Just what you were saying about the mask. I mean, the rescuer's mask.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, that's definitely more signaling.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, to me, that is the, what Kate Spade's husband, when he did that, it just, I thought that was so wrong and so just awful.
It's one of the more blatant.
I know.
Displays of signaling I've ever seen.
I know. It was horrific. And, when I think about this, the House Un-American Activities Committee, one of the things that if you guys haven't watched, Trumbo, which has Bryan Cranston in it, it's all about Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted, and he was just such an amazing writer who won multiple Academy Awards that he was hired under all kinds of pseudonyms, and he basically kept working because he was so good. But other writers didn't have that opportunity because they weren't quite as good. Everybody just said, oh my gosh, here, you gotta do this. And as much as I hate Kirk Douglas, he was somebody who championed and got Trumbo basically off the blacklist because he wanted Trumbo and only Trumbo to write Spartacus. And Kirk Douglas was big enough star where they said, all right, you can have him write it and we'll give him public credit for it. And so he got himself off the blacklist. He was given, he got an Academy Award for Best Story for Roman Holiday. And that was given to a front writer, even though it was Trumbo's. And then for The Brave One, it was awarded to a pseudonym of Trumbo's. And so there was when the Academy Award was given, nobody went to pick it up because Trumbo couldn't show himself. You know, just he was so good. And that so there's a movie about it. And then I'm trying to – there's also a documentary, which I found actually – as a great companion piece to the movie, because the movie is a Hollywood movie and it kind of skims over a lot of the details And the documentary actually interviews his children and talks about how that all happened. And it talks about how they went to Mexico and tried to live there for a while. So, you know, if you get a chance, I can't remember what the documentary is called, but just Trumbo documentary and you could probably find it. But it really kind of shows the effect of what this did to people. You know, they're making Hollywood money and the writing, and all of a sudden they get named as a name. And in Trumbo's case, he actually went to jail for a year because of the fact that he was convicted for contempt of Congress. He didn't want to give any information. And so Congress said, well, you're going to talk or we're going to hold you in contempt. And he says, no, I'm not going to give you any information. So he was convicted for contempt of Congress, and he appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court, and he served 11 months. I think it was 11 months in jail. And there was this documentary, a different one called Hollywood on Trial. And Trumbo said, as far as I was concerned, it was a completely just verdict. I had contempt for that Congress and have had contempt for several since. And on the basis of guilt or innocence, I could never really complain very much. That this was a crime or misdemeanor was the complaint, my complaint. And then when that happened and it said, you know, Trumbo and everybody else, they're not going to be permitted to work in the industry unless they disavowed communism under oath. So, I mean, he ended up writing, I think, 30 scripts under pseudonyms. And I mean, so he worked steadily, and it was, but others couldn't. And it just destroyed their lives. And, you know, some committed suicide, and it's just all because people like Kazan just wanted to protect themselves and their own interests and didn't really care about anybody else.
Well, yeah, because the list is so long that you have to imagine at some point they just started making up names because he needed likely as much evidence as he possibly could have to hand over to save his butt. I mean, you have names on here like Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, Katharine Hepburn, and you've got Judy Garland. And you have Louis Mayer saying, oh, no, 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 you don't get the Garland. You know, he puts her on his lap and he's like, look, she's American Pie. You know, take her off the list and she becomes unscathed. But these other actors and actresses, they had to go through the whole congressional hearing. They had to go to another meeting and make a deal. And one out of the 42 did not get a deal.
So speaking of the Harvey time, it was about when Harvey was first exposed in October, November 2017. And there was this actress turned novelist, and she decided to speak up about her own experiences. And her name is Carol Drinkwater. And she went on Facebook back in October of 2017. And she said that she was very badly damaged in her 20s by a director as famous as Harvey Weinstein, more so, that it took her years to get over it. And then she lost a mighty role because she would not play along, would not sleep with the director in question. And in that Facebook post, at least, she didn't mention the name of her abuser. She said, even though he's dead, I still did not say his name. But she writes, she's a novelist. And there was a novel that came out about the same time called The Lost Girl. And in that, the wannabe starlet Marguerite is raped by a famous director with a Greek-sounding surname. And, you know, it's just, it just shows, and it was Elliot Kazan who did this to her. And it was an awful, awful thing. And I'm trying to, so she starts talking about later in, and she said that her first encounter was in this guy's apartment. And the guy was Sam Spiegel. And it was an adaptation of The Last Tycoon, which was F. Scott Fitzgerald's, he never finished it before he died, but so it was being produced by Sam Spiegel and it was written by Harold Pinter and it was going to be directed by Elie Kazan. He was already in his 60s by then. And they were so confident, Spiegel and Pinter, that she was a shoo-in that, they involved her for months in the development of her character. So, I mean, she was involved in this for months and months and months. And then she meets Kazan in Spiegel's apartment, and then she was asked to go to a meeting at his production office the following week. So she says, I went in on a Monday, and was put in a private room. We started to do a little bit of the script, and in no time, he pushed me up against the wall. He pinned me there with his hands on either side of me and pressed himself up against me hard, kissing my neck. I was completely freaked and didn't know what was going on. My first thought was, is this method directing? It's not Birmingham repertory. I tried to wriggle away from him, and he said, if you don't show me passion, you can't play this role. And we spent the morning with him pushing and pulling at me. He said, okay, come in tomorrow. And this went on for a week. Because I didn't realize what was going on, I turned up like a good girl. And then the screen test itself was scheduled for the following week. And when I arrived, the studio was completely empty, a huge, big black space. And she was waiting in the dressing room when there was a knock on the door, and he came in, threw me back on the sofa, started pulling in my clothes, forcibly trying to have sex with me. And she managed to shake him off by insisting she needed to concentrate on her lines, but went into the screen test completely shaken. And then when she went into the test, the abuse started again with the camera rolling because he was whispering obscenities in her ear, she says, pushing her about in a way that couldn't be seen by anyone else, however hard she tried to get their attention. I froze. I was like a wooden spoon. The cameraman must have been wondering where the hell they had found this girl because I could not act anymore. At some point, they said, cut, finish. The lights went out and nobody said a word to me. In the evening, Kazan phoned her at her apartment and invited her to join him at the hotel. And she said, I said, I haven't got the part, have I? And then Spiegel called her the next day, said it was the worst screen test he'd ever seen, and assured her he was going to destroy the film for the good of her career. And so weeks later, Spiegel takes her out to dinner, asks what had gone wrong. And she says, I mentioned what had happened, and I suppose he's seen it more than a million times. And then Spiegel said that before the screen test, Kazan had told him, she hasn't got the song Freud for Hollywood. I'll prove it to you. It wasn't just that this man had humiliated and abused me. It was that the whole thing was some kind of setup of Kazan's own making. So, I mean, this is, it was just crazy.
And that guy is seedy. It makes me wonder if that cameraman had seen that type of activity before.
Yeah.
From Kazan, because, you know, it's not his first rodeo. He went on to abuse so many different women. And the fact that he came here from another country just to do that is kind of gross.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, brilliant, don't get me wrong, brilliant cinematographer, brilliant Broadway. But the man personally, he, you know, he had his inner demons.
He was not a good person. And, you know, he would probably tell you, you know, that he was just trying to get the best performance out of her or something like that. And, but you know, this is a time where, I mean, the casting couch was not just the casting couch. It was, if you don't want to be on the casting couch, I'm just going to rape you anyway. And
oh, that's it was the rape couch. Oh yeah. It was the rape or be blacklist couch.
Yeah. And you know, it just, and there's all kinds of times during that there was, a studio boss who had, I think it was between 4 and 4:30 every day. He was, quote unquote, in auditions. And that was, you know, that was the time that he had sex every single day with some actress who wanted to either keep her job or get a job. I can't remember who it was, but he had a white couch and the whole, office was white. And then that couch just stood out there. And he also, there wasn't any video recording, but he had audio recordings of all of these actresses and everything, and he would always threaten to use them against them if they said anything. And, you know, it was just, it was all about power. And, you know, this whole method acting, to me, especially with Elie Kazan, is that it's the same kind of thing that James Franco said before he got his acting school, essentially saying, oh, you know, the best thing to do would be to run an acting school because you have all these people at their most vulnerable and then you could do whatever you want with them. And then later James Franco did do just that. And so you have Elie Kazan with this method acting and, you know, you can kind of blame it all on the method acting. Oh, you know, it's just, I'm trying to get the passion up and intense and, you know, to have this. And it's kind of a built-in excuse to have your behavior be justified.
Well, yeah, because he moved in on Marilyn Monroe when she was at her weakest. So that's just the type of man that he is. You know, he hits you when you're vulnerable. And then he goes on to write letters about how he likes bad boys because he himself was a bad boy. You know, he wrote about James Dean and he just said, this guy's got some balls and he's also got some real problems. You know, he's a good actor, but he's got a real mean streak. So you could tell the type of people he gravitated towards.
He was not a nice guy, and I was trying to, I wanted to read that, oh, there it is, the letter again that he wrote. I mean, just the way he wrote to his wife about Marilyn. First of all, he's telling his wife, I don't really care what you think. And then he was like, saying she was, talking about, you know, Marilyn. Oh, she was a stray cat when I got to know her. And I got a lot out of her, just as you do from any human experience where anyone's revealed to you and you affect anyone in any way. I guess I gave her a lot of hope, and just like, he's the best person in the whole world. And if you don't understand the fact that he was wanting to have sex with her, then fine, divorce me. I don't care. I'll find somebody else. I'll have no problems finding somebody else, and I'll probably cheat on them too. And, you know, it's just.
Oh, he could care less. I mean, he wrote Warren Beatty, and he just told him, stop being a diva. Because Warren Beatty was asking some career advice, and, you know, Kazan gave it to him flat. He was like, look, quit being a diva. And if you want to work with us elite directors and, you know, these director glamour boys, they don't want to hear that you're difficult. You know, you need to comply. So if that was his mindset, then, yeah, he was a bad guy.
And, you know, the one part where he said, where he met her on Harmon Jones' set, Harmon thought her a ridiculous person and was fashionably scornful of her. I found her when I was introduced in tears. I took her to dinner because she seemed like a touching, pathetic waif. She sobbed all through dinner. So, and he said, you couldn't help being touched. She was talented, funny, vulnerable, helpless, in awful pain, with no hope. And that's kind of where he was, going with that. It was
didn't
just,
he go on to call her one of, like, this is like Charlie Chaplin's like biggest heroine, like she's all these characters in one. She's just a total Greek tragedy.
And then with he said that thing to Warren Beatty, it's very regrettable that so many people think of you as a special problem or something like that. I mean, he had all kinds. I'm trying to find the Warren Beatty one. It says to Warren Beatty, forgive the impertinence of a friend. I really do like you, and it disheartens me when I hear from the underground that you're giving everybody a bad time in Maryland. I know rumors are unreliable, and it's not right to repeat them, but damn it, they dishearten me. I always say Warren at bottom is a damn fine guy, but there's some contradiction all through your behavior. On one hand, you say that you want to be a movie star. You've said it again and again, not only to me, but to lots of people. But I must tell you that becoming a first-flight movie star depends, as you well know, on working with the elite directors, like you said. And, you know, it just... But at the same time, like you said, he is also difficult. And also, you know, it's just –
he's difficult and he prays. I mean, the whole reason Marilyn Monroe was crying was because the guy that she was living with at the time, who was her – what was he? Her agent, be-all, say-all?
He dies.
Yep. And then the family does not allow her not only to see him in the hospital. She could hear him screaming from his hospital bed as she was outside in the hospital hallway. But she also could not get back into the home after he passed away, not even to collect her belongings because the family forbid it. So she climbed in the window and they called the police and of course put her back out. That put her back at the studio set crying. That's how Kazan found her. But he goes on to write his wife and he says, you know, she's like you said, a stray cat, and she's crying over this guy who, I'm just going to be mean, is basically her handler, her keeper.
Yeah.
He makes fun of her the whole time.
I know. It just, that's what I'm saying. It's just like, He has no respect for any, he doesn't have respect for Marilyn in that letter. He doesn't have respect for his wife in that letter. And
no respect and no empathy.
No. And he said, this is a famous quote of his, and he explained, it was talking about casting couches, and he explained that studio heads thought of every film they made, no matter how serious the theme, as a love story. As a result, he said, they went by a simple rule and a useful one. Do I want to F her? And he justified that phrase by saying the audience must be interested in the film's people in this elemental way. If the producer wasn't interested in an actress this way, he was convinced an audience wouldn't be.
Yes, because he wrote John Steinbeck something like that about East of Eden. He talks about the female lead. And he just said, my God, you're going to think I'm nuts. I know you are. He's like, but I couldn't find a 20-something. He was like, all those girls think about prom dresses and bows, and they are nothing. These girls are nothing. No good for my scenes. So he goes on to talk about hiring an older actress, and by his idea of older, she was probably, what, 4 years older?
Yeah.
He was like, if I move the camera fast enough, I can make her look young enough, and it won't be too bothersome, and she looks okay with Jimmy Dean, you know? She might work.
You know, it's just... And I mean, that kind of just shows what, you know, he believed in the casting couch too. And it's Daryl Zanuck. That's the one who had the 4 to 4:30, conferences. And, you know, and Zanuck, he was married to Virginia Fox, and in 1956, he went to Europe, even though he's married to Virginia, and he hooked up, lived with, shacked up with three French mistresses and would brag about it. And it just, I mean, and he totally humiliated his wife, and he probably didn't care. And these conferences that he had, this is how little, so these actresses would have to come. And sometimes he would greet them half naked. He would only have his upper body clothed. Sometimes he would show off this life-size mold of his private parts in solid gold.
Tapes.
Well, Joan Crawford once said, I've seen bigger things crawl out of cabbages. So, you know, but I mean, and Joan Crawford, I mean, she had her own history with the casting couch. I mean, she made the soft porn movie Casting Couch. And that's the one that it was a silent movie from about 1923, and they destroyed whatever copies they could find, and then they paid a blackmailer $100,000. And also, it was around this time that, you know, the word bimbo, well, it's Italian for young man, but apparently when they started applying to women, it was an acronym for body immaculate, brains optional. And, you know, these were the kind of guys, and, you know, and they all said, oh, Elia, I mean, this is just who he was. And I think he firmly believed that, you know, he was some kind of gift to the world and to women, and they should all be grateful for him or something. And, I mean, he was a great director. But that's really.
But the brilliant ones, you know, a lot of them are bad. They are just the worst of the worst. And like you said, they have pack mentality. They stick together, and when they're together, they act worse. This whole casting couch situation and abusing women is terrible.
Well, you know what? I think next week we need to go back to a murder, because the real life that does not a murder is more depressing than the people who actually die. I don't even know.
okay, yeah, anyway. So get off me. Okay, I can still be sponsored by Sprite. I can bring back kids and bodies, and it's fine. Because this was just as depressing, and it had none of that.
I know. You can catch Jen on Twitter at Mascara Mace and on patreon.com/deadanddocumented. It was interesting to go a lot of different directions in this episode and not just be focused on one thing. It's good to branch off, talk about other people, things that, you know, so, and he touched so many different people that you can go in a lot of different directions. So
that's why I like the subject, because your blog is amazing. And there had been so many different, you had some blinds up there about him. And also a lot of the interestings had commented about his name, even when he did not pertain to the blinds. So that kind of sparked a little bit of interest. So he just kind of fit right in. He's just, you know, he's the gift that keeps on giving. Just a big old long story. And I love your knowledge. You know, that's always amazing.
Well, I appreciate you. And I will see you again next week.
Yes. Happy Sunday. Bye.
Happy Sunday. Bye.